Chardin, chardin, de cuir. voyage autour de la vision sur le chantier. Il est pris son silève qui gronde, il a saveur forcenée de six effets. Très solide. Les lisières ont exploité vos mondes. Ils ont besoin et peuvent essayer de faire prendre la brillante faculté et d'arrêter l'immense de votre patience. Quels hommes mûrs! À la façon de la nuit, roses et noires, tricolores, tasses et piques et étoiles, tors, des fascistes déformés, plombis, plimis, incendiés, des enlouements folâtres, la démarche cruelle des horribles. Bohémien, niais, hyène, moloch, vieilles démons sinistres, ils mêlent leur cour populaire maternelle avec des causes et des tasses bestiales. Ils ont préparé des pièces nouvelles et des chansons bas. Maître jongleur, il transforme les lues, les personnes mises de la comédie magnétique. J'y
Ben Bostridge live at the Proms singing Les Illuminations by Benjamin Britten with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Harding. That haunting returning phrase of the words in Rambo, J'ai seul la clé de cette parade sauvage, I alone have the key to this savage parade. And then that final rather haunting ending, Daniel Harding expertly holding the silence here in the hall for what felt like many seconds indeed. Benjamin Britten finished writing that in 1939. It's dated Amityville, 25th of October, 1939. So just think, as Ian Bostridge was saying to me earlier, about what was happening in Europe at that time as Britten was watching from America. Really interesting to hear that work alongside Tippett's Concerto for the String Orchestra earlier. Tippett, of course, pacifist, conscientious objector, Britten too, very important to both composers. Tippett was to go on to write A Child of Our Time, Britten the War Requiem. But as Ian Bostridge was saying earlier, there's also the exoticism and the hustle and bustle and energy of the cities in which Rambo the poet and Britten the composer were living at that time, London and New York respectively. Ian Bostridge back on stage applauding the strings of the London Symphony Orchestra. It's Daniel Harding shaking the hand of principal cellist Rebecca Gilliver, a wonderful solo in that, and also the leader of the LSO tonight, Carmine Lowry. Ian Bostridge is very busy at the moment, as so many great musicians are over the summer. He's just been in Salzburg, he's now off to Edinburgh, where he and the pianist Lars Falk are giving an evening recital at the Usher Hall on Thursday, part of the International Festival. And then he's back at the Proms for a chamber music concert on Monday, the 2nd of September. He's singing Dowland. And if you enjoyed listening to that Britten, of course, there's masses of his music in this, his centenary year at the Proms. There's a dedicated page for Britten on the Proms website. If you go to the homepage and click on Listen and Watch, you'll find a massive store there of Britten performances, including a wonderful one of the Abraham and Isaac Canticle from James Gilchrist, Ruby Hughes and Imogen Cooper. And all of the Proms chamber music concerts are being filmed, so you can watch them exclusively online, as you will be able to with Bostridge's Dowland Prom on Monday the 2nd of September. Here he is again, an incredibly popular Proms performer. And if you missed the very beginning of this live Prom on Radio 3, don't forget you can listen again for 7 days after broadcast. Ian Bostridge had some lovely memories and thoughts about Colin Davis, the conductor who died in April and in whose memory this London Symphony Orchestra concert is being performed. Well, coming up in the second half, Elgar's Second Symphony, but first we're going to stay with Britten for a Proms Plus literary event which was held earlier today over the road at the Royal College of Music. We join Ian McMillan and guests to discuss the literary inspiration for Britten's work.
Welcome to this Proms Plus event recorded in front of an audience hungry for enlightenment and joy here at the Royal College of Music in the glorious and nourishing shadow of the Albert Hall. Today, in his centenary year, we'll be looking at the composer Benjamin Britten's relationship to poetry, how he set it, how he understood it in relation to music, how it shaped him. Boris Ford, the editor of an anthology of the poems Britten set to music, wrote of his dependence on poems and his unerring choice of poems which led him into emotional realms he might not have ventured into, which is, of course, what poetry always does. Joining me to venture into emotional realms we might not normally approach on a Tuesday evening, I'm joined by Alexandra Harris, who teaches English at the University of Liverpool and who's one of our Radio 3 New Generation thinkers, and by the actor Samuel West, who's got a particular love of Benjamin Britten's work, and the poems will be read by Malcolm Sinclair. So I'm interested in your personal connections to Britten. So Alexandra, what's your connection, do you think, to Britten?
Well, I'm afraid I met him quite late, strangely in my PhD viva, which was quite a tense moment to meet him. And my examiner suggested that he might be quite central to my thesis about how writers and artists in the 40s were going back to their roots, which is, of course, exactly what Britton did when he came home to Aldborough and wrote Peter Grimes.
And Samuel, what about you? How did you meet him?
I remember Wayne Levy coming into our music class when I was 10 and telling me he was dead. It was something actually, even in a sort of small primary school, that mattered to 10-year-olds because, you know, he was always a friend to children. By then I was well into Young Person's Guide, I still am, and I knew about Noise Flood, which is a piece I've only just managed to do. So yeah, he was somebody who seemed to care about making music for children from as long as I can remember, really.
And Malcolm, I believe that you played him.
Yeah, I played him at the National Theatre in The Habit of Art, the Alan Bennett play. And we toured it about his relationship with Auden. And I saw him conduct a couple of times. I saw him at the Albert Hall, and he conducted War Requiem with Giulini. And what was so extraordinary was Giulini was his incredibly commanding figure, as you can imagine, and Britton looked rather insignificant behind him conducting the chamber ensemble. And the other thing I remember from it was that the hall was only just two-thirds full. Wasn't even full.
So thinking about the poetry then, Alexandra, what do you think characterises his choices of poetry?
Britton is a very unusual and eclectic kind of reader, actually, which is partly why he loved to read anthologies. There were so many anthologies in his library. Boris Ford makes a great long list of them. I don't think we really appreciate anthologies these days. We tend to get the complete works of Tennyson. But Britton would go to a collection of madrigals. He would go to a collection of flower poems. And he loved the joy of discovery. He loved finding, for example, the poetry of Crabbe. He loved being able to say, we've just discovered George Crabbe. And each of his findings come with a whole kind of narrative around them, when he first read it, where he was. He loved to juxtapose poems, so he is himself a great anthologist. So in something like the Spring Symphony, he'll give us the medieval spring songs we expect, and then Auden's Out on the Lawn I Lie in Bed, with violent sounds from Poland coming through in the middle, strange contrasts. He'll invoke the pastoral, but then give us the shadowiness underneath it. Peter Porter writes a brilliant essay about him in which he says there's nothing of the half-timbered in Britton's choice of poetry. And I think that's very telling about his suspicion of oldie England. And yet he wants to find a way of being English, but without the half-timber and the real ale.
Well, let's see an example of Britton's eclectic taste with our first reading. It's Christopher Smart's I Will Consider My Cat Geoffrey from Rejoice in the Lamb.
For I will consider my cat Geoffrey, for he is the servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him. For at the first glance of the glory of God in the east, he worships in his way. For this is done by wreathing his body seven times round with elegant quickness. For he knows that God is his saviour. For God has blessed him in the variety of his movements. For there is nothing sweeter than his peace when at rest. For I am possessed of a cat surpassing in beauty, from whom I take occasion to bless Almighty God. For the mouse is a creature of great personal valor. For this is a true case. Cat takes female mouse will not depart, but stands threatening and daring. If you will let her go, I will engage you as prodigious a creature as you are. For the mouse is a creature of great personal valour. For the mouse is of an hospitable disposition. For the flowers are great blessings. For the flowers have their angels, even the words of God's creation. For the flower glorifies God, and the root parries the adversary. For there is a language of flowers. For flowers are peculiarly the poetry of Christ.
Alexander, that's an odd, quirky poem to start with, but also a strange choice for a poem to celebrate the anniversary of the consecration of a church.
Well, that's it. This is a commission for a good community piece for Northampton Church. And Britain thinks, well, obviously we must do My Cat Geoffrey by this totally unknown poet, Christopher Smart, and Walter Hussey, the vicar of St. Matthew's, who was known for very Catholic tastes. Even he was a bit surprised by this choice, a little bit anxious about how it was going to go down. But of course, it was a triumph, and it just shows you how Britain finds what's familiar and funny and also sacred in poems which look quite alarming. It was written by Christopher Smart when he was in an asylum, and he worked on it over 4 years and would add to it. It was like a diary almost, and all he had in the world was his room and his cat and obviously a passing mouse. And clearly he manages to make his whole cosmic vision brought to bear on the cat and the mouse. Extraordinary.
And am I right in thinking that Christopher Smart's poems were lost for many years and they found him in a drawer?
Well, this one was. Mm. I mean, he was known as a sort of minor poet, but Rejoice in the Lamb wasn't made public until it was found in a library in Suffolk, where it had been passed down through the generations. And the editor, William Forstead, published an edition of it in 1939. So when Britain set this in 1943... it was cutting-edge stuff. It may be 18th century, but it was brand new.
And was reading and discovering poetry something that Britain and Arden did together?
I think so, yes.
Now, Sam, I know you narrated Nightmare at the Proms a few years ago. Did that give you an insight into how Britain and Arden's collaboration worked?
The thing that's frustrating about performing Nightmare live, because obviously it's a narration of a GPO film about the train that carries mail to Scotland, is that the central portion, which begins letters of thanks, letters from banks, letters of joy from the girl and the boy, receipted bills and invitations, etc., is so long that you can't actually breathe. the piece is, strictly speaking, unperformable. And I've done it live 5 times now, and I've only got that entry right 3 times. So I think probably it was a work at the early end of Britain and Auden's collaboration, and they perhaps got better at the mechanical aspects of setting words like that. But yes, there's obviously a great joy of discovery that Britain has in poets like Smart that I imagine he and Auden found together. And the enthusiasm with which he selects and the enthusiasm with which he anthologizes is extremely unusual for a composer, I think. He obviously gets a sense that he has a right to do this from his mate.
Now, another element of their relationship involved Auden educating Britain about politics. And while Auden was writing what some called propaganda, Britain's approach was more indirect. Britain chose Wilfred Owen's The Kind Ghosts to set as part of Nocturne in 1958. So let's hear that, Malcolm.
She sleeps on soft last breaths, but no ghost looms out of the stillness of her palace wall, her wall of boys on boys and dooms on dooms. She dreams of golden gardens and sweet glooms, not marvelling why her roses never fall, nor what red mouths were torn to make their blooms. The shades keep down which well might roam her hall. Quiet their blood lies in her crimson rooms, and she is not afraid of their footfall. They move not from her tapestries, their pall, nor pace her terraces, their hecatombs, lest aught she be disturbed or grieved at all.
That's a less known poem of Owen's, isn't it? And I wonder what made you choose that one?
Well, I think the wall recreation Requiem Owen poems have become quite familiar to us, but I wanted to choose this, which Britten set as part of Nocturne, because it's not explicitly a poem from the trenches. Mm. And it says something to me about the indirections of Britten's methods. Here's a poem which is about not haunting, which is, of course, one of the most haunted of poems. Here's a poem in which the nation is a succulent, sensuous woman envisaged as a kind of sleeping Britannia. And there's a way in which this is a poem about nationhood, about patriotism, and yet it's also so intimate, so private, so sensual, erotic. It brings together, for me, Britten's combination of the bareness, the horror, the bodies piled upon bodies, but also the lushness, the decadent part of Britten, which I think is there all through his career. You know, he remains in love with Keats, for example, and there's a Keatsian element in this.
I'm a member of the Wilfred Owen Society, and I think that's Keatsian richness coupled with a barely suppressed fury. I think this poem is more angry than you do. I think that the futility of people dying in order to keep these women or this woman, you know, happy at home, blind to the realities of the front, is barely controlled. In fact, the last line, "Lest aught she be disturbed or grieved at all," reminded me of the last line of Futility, "What made fatuous sunbeams toil to break earth's sleep at all?" You know, this powerful rhetorical question which just goes into air. But there is a kind of Keatsian richness about it. In fact, the next poem in the anthology, in Nocturne, is Sleep and Poetry by John Keats. And that's, I think, what makes him... It's a step forward from the early 30s pacifism, which is sometimes quite strident and banner-waving. And I think a step forward from the sort of flirtations with communism that saw him setting things like Night Mail and dedicating them to the men of the LMS.
It's now time for a few questions from the audience, thinking of things that sit inside the skull. Gentlemen, right at the back.
Would like the panellists to comment on tonight's setting, because we've talked about settings of English poetry, but not about Britten's settings of French. And I'm conversant with French, and French native French speakers don't seem, although they love music, to be very satisfied with Britten's settings of Rimbaud, for example. So could I have some comments? We have some comments about that.
We were discussing what Britten might have seen in Rimbaud before we came on, and Malcolm said simply, "Sexy." I wonder if he turned towards French poetry rather like hipsters turned towards French cinema in the 1950s, you know, got you into better parties. I think possibly it expressed something about his own, as yet fully, not fully understood sexuality.
Yes, because I think when he did set the Michelangelo sonnets in obviously in Italian, I mean, that has a whole gay subtext, well, not really subtext. And I think it was a way of expressing those feelings that could not perhaps be expressed otherwise. I mean, there's that line in Les Illuminations, "Le double sexe." I mean, it's all... I mean, when I heard it for the first time, I thought it was sexy, actually.
Now, Britten left England for America in 1939, and while he was there, he discovered the work of our next poet, George Crabbe. Here's Marsh Flowers from Five Flower Songs.
Here the strong mallow strikes her slimy root. Here the dull nightshade hangs her deadly fruit. On hills of dust the henbane's faded green and pencilled flower of sickly scent is seen. Here on its wiry stem in rigid bloom grows a salt lavender that lacks perfume. At the wall's base, the fiery nettle springs with fruit globose and fierce with poison stings. In every chink delights the fern to grow, with glossy leaf and tawny bloom below. The few dull flowers that all the place are spread partake the nature of their fenny bed. These, with our seaweeds rolling up and down, form the contracted flora of our town.
So, Alexander, we've mentioned that Crabbe was one of these kind of peripheral poets, if you like, that Britain discovered. And what was the impact, do you think, of your discovery of Crabbe?
Wow, the impact. Isn't that the best trip to the florist shop ever? I just love it. I mean, that was set as one of five flower poems. And it's Britain's sort of bouquet. It's a wedding anniversary present. And what you would expect in a wedding bouquet would be, you know, daffodils and tulips. And you get a few of those, and then you get the slimy weeds. And Britain clearly is very much drawn to this alternative pastoral, this vision of a place which is grim and bleak and real. And that's what struck him when he read E.M. Forster's article in the Listener magazine in 1941 about George Crabbe. Piers and Britain were at this point in Escondido, California, having a pretty grim sort of summer, not enjoying themselves. And then they read Forster on George Crabbe, and they read Forster's kind of ode to a poet who has a different sense of beauty, who goes to a place which is bleak and portrays its characters with absolute authenticity and steely nerve. And Forster talks about Crabbe as really belonging to Aldborough, and through Aldborough belonging to Britain. And Britain felt that he realised in that moment what he was lacking, what he had to go back to. So he went back to the slimy weeds.
But he had this tendency as well to anthologise poets when he set them, sometimes combining lines from different poems by the same poet. Why did he do that, do you think?
Yeah, it's a very audacious thing to do, isn't it? And he would, just put a pencil mark straight through parts of Shakespeare. He'd rewrite the Bible. Yeah. That was no trouble at all. There's clearly a sense of the work of art, the music, having its own integrity, and so it's absolutely his right to make something new. And it's part of his homage to the power of the original poem, that it is flexible enough to change, that it's something that lives. I think he really does see these things as living verses that want to be transfigured in the present, that want to be made new.
Sammy did the same with Owen, didn't he?
Yes, he did, in War Requiem. Yes, he cuts a big wodge of Strange Meeting, which is a fairly famous poem, and also changes a couplet, which is quite complex in the original. Well, in fact, he turns it into two lines. Even with truths that lie too deep for taint, I would have poured my spirit without stint, but not through wounds, not on the cess of war. Foreheads of men have bled where no wounds were, which is quite a complex passage, and he replaces that with, even from wells we sunk too deep for war, even the sweetest wells that ever were, which has got a lot of vowels in it, is much easier to understand. So, and in fact, we know from his workbooks that Owen had great problems with that bit. So I think the answer to your question, why did he do it, is because he could.
Now, Aldborough was Britain's home till he died there in 1976. And our final poem takes on the idea of home. It's by Thomas Hardy, and it's The Little Old Table from Winter Words.
Creak, little wood thing, creak, when I touch you with elbow or knee. That is the way you speak of one who gave you to me. You little table she brought me with her own hand, as she looked at me with a thought that I did not understand. Whoever owns it anon and hears it will never know what a history hangs upon this creek from long ago.
So, Alexander, what do you think that poem tells us about Britain's choice, Britain's sense of home?
I think it takes us back to his spareness and bareness and his sense of Hardy controlling all that sprawling, complex emotion and pushing it towards this one wooden table which just won't creak enough, won't creak eloquently enough. And Britain allows Hardy, in a way, that voice. He lets the tenor voice turn into that creaking table.
Malcolm, as somebody who's played him, did you get the sense that he felt at home in the idea of words and the place of words and music side by side?
Yes, I mean, I think when you listen to him speak, he speaks in a rather old-fashioned way to us, of course, but he's incredibly articulate. He's someone who read all the time and was used to speaking, and you listen to him rehearsing orchestras and choirs, unbelievably articulate and very decisive.
Thank you very much to Samuel West, Alexandra Harris and Malcolm Sinclair. Benjamin Britten's Poets, a collection of all the work he set to music, is out now from Carcanet Press. Goodbye.
And that was Ian McMillan with today's Proms Plus literary event, which happened across the road at the Royal College of Music earlier on today, and it was produced by Ellie Bury. And if your interest in Britain is spiked by that, there's more Britain at the Proms over the coming weeks. On Saturday, lots of his music in the Proms Saturday matinee at 3 o'clock. And then, of course, Billy Budd from Glyndebourne on Tuesday the 27th next week. That's prom number 60. You can find out full details of the Proms on the BBC Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. And everyone is, of course, live here on BBC Radio 3, where we're back now at the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, given by the London Symphony Orchestra and their principal guest conductor, Daniel Harding. This concert being given in memory of Sir Colin Davis, such a long and close association with the London Symphony Orchestra, who died in April. We've already heard music by Tippett, his concerto for double string orchestra, and Ian Bostridge singing Britain's Les Illuminations. If you missed those two performances, you can catch them online for 7 days or in the radio repeat on Monday at 2 o'clock. Now, just one work in the second part of this concert, Elgar's Second Symphony, which he wrote over 2 years around 1910, a piece that had really big personal significance for him. He said in a letter to his muse, Alice, that he had written his soul into this symphony. It lasts nearly an hour. It begins with incredible briskness and ebullience and ends in quite a poignant way. During the writing of the symphony, King Edward VII died, and it was in his memory that Elgar dedicated his second symphony. Right at the top of the score of his second symphony, Elgar quotes Shelley, "Rarely, rarely comest thou, spirit of delight." The spirit of delight currently making his way on stage is Carmine Lowry, the leader of the London Symphony Orchestra tonight, taking applause here at a completely packed Royal Albert Hall. And the second spirit of delight following close behind him, conductor Daniel Harding. Sit back and enjoy Elgar's Second Symphony, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra live here at the BBC Proms.